On behalf of the National Kidney Foundation's People Like Us, welcome to Helping Transplant Patients Prepare for and Cope in the Aftermath of a Natural Disaster or Other Emergency. I am the National Kidney Foundation Transplant Services Director, and today's telephone conference has been prepared to help social workers, NKF local affiliate offices, and other support group facilitators lead a discussion group with transplant recipients on this topic. Today's conference is part of NKF's Coffee House Conversations program series. Our goal today is to provide you with information and tools that will help facilitate this discussion with recipients. With great pleasure, I wish to introduce you to our Blue Ribbon panel in the order in which they will speak. Dr. Tim Kern, Marion O'Rourke, Deborah Washington, and Dean Collier. Dr. Kern has been a physician with the U.S. Public Health Service, Indian Health Service, for 20 years, with extensive experience in general surgery, urology, and emergency medicine. Dr. Kern retired from full-time service in 2003 and continues as a medical officer, urology liaison, surgical services part-time at the Gallup Indian Medical Center in Gallup, New Mexico. He volunteers with the National Kidney Foundation and 36 years ago, in 1971, he had a kidney transplant. Deborah Washington is a retired Army nurse with nearly 17 years working in the U.S. and overseas. She has a bachelor's degree in healthcare administration and currently volunteers with the American Red Cross, Walter Reed Army Medical Center, with returning Iraqi soldiers as well as with dialysis and kidney patients, the Washington Regional Transplant Consortium, and the NKF. Deborah received a kidney from a deceased donor 10 years ago in 1997. Dean Scott Collier, pharmacy, Doctor of Pharmacy, is currently a clinical pharmacist at the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha, where he completed a fellowship in immunotherapy in the early 1990s. He's a professor of pharmacy and graduated from the University of Iowa College of Pharmacy in the 1980s. Currently, he consults with the University of Nebraska Transplant Programs and is the pharmacy editor for NKF's Transplant Chronicles. He has a long history conducting research to study immunosuppression. He has also published extensively and been an invited speaker at numerous professional transplant meetings. And I did say this out of order, but our second speaker today will be Marion O'Rourke. She is a registered nurse with extensive experience in transplantation and administrative management. Since 2004, she's been the director of the Abdominal Transplant Tulane University Hospital and Clinic in New Orleans. Her list of accomplishments are significant and too many to mention here, but currently she is the president of the North American Transplant Coordinators Organization and is a board member at large of the United Network for Organ Sharing. She has also published extensively and has been an invited speaker at numerous professional transplant meetings. We have a lot to cover, so let's get started. Dr. Kern?
Thank you, Kathy. It's a real privilege to be here with everybody and to have this opportunity to really be, for all of us, the point of the spear in terms of laying the groundwork for identification of problems within this area. And my subject will be the preparation and action, a disaster plan for transplant recipients. And it's interesting, just a little background. There's very little in the literature that really points to helping us and guiding us and to providing recommendations for transplant recipients in relation to disasters, both natural and unnatural, and crises that people that they face almost on a daily basis. And we certainly are aware of natural disasters that we've seen in the last several years and the impact on people's lives. And again, it's just interesting in the literature from the review that I did, there's very little in the literature regarding the real personal needs of immunocompromised, i.e. kidney transplant patients. And that's really going to be the focus of my topic today and also the discussion afterwards, which I encourage everybody to do. And really the focus of this is going to be a scenario, and I'll get to that in just a minute. And this is a real live patient with real life problems and real life situation that occurred many, many years ago, and it's a natural disaster, but it really, I thought it would be important to present this because it brings up a lot of different facets of the subject at hand and really has us, I want people to really think about the unmet needs of this very unique group of patients and really what it involves in not knowing and the uncertainty of disaster, the ongoing relationships that are needed and the basic needs that are required, and finally on what the patient can be doing and what is required of them to maintain their health during these times of crises. So really it has to do with not knowing, ongoing, and doing. I've kind of put that into a little rhyming sentence there, but I think the scenario will reflect that. And so kind of that's kind of a pre-introduction. And my real introduction is as follows. A scenario is presented that describes the multifaceted needs of a renal transplant patient and her family. Oftentimes, the essentials, water, food, shelter, warmth, communication, etc., go beyond the physical and involve concerns that are unmet at a time of crisis or disaster. It is hopeful that this scenario will stimulate discussion of the unique and challenging requirements that transplant recipients have during a time of disaster, particularly when access to medical care is limited, medications are running out, and family members cannot be contacted or are disabled themselves. The purpose of this scenario or case study is to reveal to the reader the fundamentals of preparation, action, and unmet needs that arise during a natural disaster that have beset a transplant patient and her family. Again, this scenario or case study is a real live patient, and this occurred many, many years ago, and I've modified it a little bit, but it is in an actual patient under actual situation. The scenario is as follows. A 57-year-old diabetic female, she's a single mom with two grown sons, received a kidney transplant 8 years ago. She takes multiple medications. She's on a total of 12 per day, including sirolimus or Cellcept. She's on maintenance prednisone. She's on 4 antihypertensive medications, and I won't list those. She's on a supplemental calcium, calcitonin and Pepcid, thyroxin and multivitamins, and she occasionally takes an herbal medicine as well. She was on hemodialysis for 4 years prior to her transplant, and at that time, during her dialysis, she underwent a left below-the-knee amputation for severe diabetic peripheral vascular disease. So she has diabetes as well, and her most recent blood sugar as well as her blood pressure were well controlled prior to the time of this natural disaster, which I'll get to in just a minute. Following her transplant, her creatinine is stabilized right around 2, and she's not had any proteinuria. So that's kind of the medical history, as it were. And then in terms of her more social and really her environmental history, as it were, and what she's able to do, again, this lady was well known to me. She occasionally uses a cane or a walker at home. She has difficulty climbing stairs. She's had multiple episodes of gastroenteritis, both upper and lower, from the Cellcept, and just really has had times when she's been non-compliant with that. She's required hospitalization during those periods of time. Excuse me. She also has an older sister who lives with her, who's on continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis for 2 years. And the older sister also has diabetes. They live together in a very isolated portion of northern Arizona. This is on the Navajo Reservation, and she gets her access, accesses her health care through the Indian Health Service. They recently, and this is many years ago now, but recently, she was hit by a very severe winter storm, 2 feet of of snow came down very, very quickly over a period of several days. There were very severe nighttime freezing temperatures below zero. Crops were affected. The stock and animals were affected as well. The National Guard were called out. Again, this was several years ago. A cell phone is available in terms of communication, but with limited minutes. She does not drive. Her eldest son lives approximately 12 miles away, but he's not often there. He works himself, and the roads are basically impassable during the wintertime. Again, as I mentioned just briefly, the patient and her family have livestock that they care for and have for many generations. So that's kind of the overview of this patient, her medical history, a little about her social and her environmental history, as it were, and how she lives, and a little bit about her family and her situation, a little bit about the actual disaster. And with these facts in mind, I wanted to look at her unique needs, number one, the essential preparation that she could provide for herself and or would be provided for her in an event of something like this, and two, the recommended action that she could take. And as I'm going through this, I really wanted everybody to kind of take to look at it in a way that again, that the patient look at it from the patient's point of view, knowing a little bit about her at this point and the patient concerns that she has, the not knowing, the ongoing, and the doing that she falls into her situation and characterizes the anxiety and the things that she's concerned about, and then the points of contact, which I'll get to, which really involve, again, the ABCs of medical care. We all are aware of that in medical terminology of airway, breathing, and cardiovascular when somebody faces an emergency, which is life-threatening. But in a disaster situation, particularly in an immunocompromised patient, such as a kidney transplant patient, the access of medical care may be limited. That's the A. The basic needs are paramount, basic needs meaning just comfort, housing, warmth, shelter, et cetera, food, and particularly medications, and three, communication. So the ABCs I've kind of coupled to the ABCs of providing emergent care, and I wanted people just to kind of keep that in mind as we go through this. This patient has a whole list of unique needs, and I just wanted to list just a few of them to put it again in perspective, to put the focus on the unique aspects of the transplant patient and her family. She's a transplant patient. She requires multiple medications that she has to take. There's anywhere from 12 to 15 at one time. She does have trouble occasionally taking them because of the multiplicity of side effects that have occurred over many years. She obviously has diabetes. She's on antihypertensive medications as well. She's at risk of infection, particularly respiratory, viral, and urinary tract infection because she's immunocompromised with being on the CellCept and the steroids and the sirolimus. She requires assistance with walking. She does not drive. She uses a cane. She's had a previous history of below-the-knee amputation. And uniquely, she lives with her sister, who also has chronic kidney disease and is on chronic ambulatory peritoneal dialysis. And this patient, her sister, requires the exchange fluids for CAPD and regular close follow-up. Her sister is also a diabetic. And has had needs related to her diabetes as well as her CAPD. Putting this in perspective, the patient has had recent recurrent histories of acute gastroenteritis, and this has really been problematic before because it has limited her compliance with their medication, and this is an area that's just very prevalent among transplant patients. She lives in a remote rural area. The cell phone is in the hands of her eldest son, but he's oftentimes not available, and during this natural disaster of this very, very severe storm, again, when the National Guard were called out, the helicopters actually came in and were providing health, not only health care immediately to people, but also to providing giving food to the animals as well, and making sure that they were taken care of. So, putting this in perspective, what is the initial preparation is kind of our next step. I've gone on over the scenario a little bit, and again, keeping in mind and trying to couple the needs of the patient to the ABCs of the access to her health care, the access to the basic needs, and to communication. And again, thinking again of the not knowing, the ongoing, and the to-doing of what the patient has to do and what their needs are and what their concerns are in terms of, and finally, to the point of contact of access, basic needs, and communication. So I'm trying to just, again, reiterating many of these things, but I think that's important. So I want to talk a little bit next about preparation, and I have a few questions, first of all, and these questions are really paramount to her situation. Again, we're focusing on this scenario of this immunocompromised kidney transplant patient and really her family. So what are her chief concerns? What can she and her family do to meet those needs? What priorities for her care are present? How would you prioritize her needs? And what lines of communication need to be established? Do you recognize any unmet needs? And I wanted to just briefly mention some of the unmet needs. As a physician and kidney transplant patient myself, I know that there are many unmet needs that patients face that oftentimes they will not address to the provider or to the patient, to their own physician. And this is something in a disaster that becomes very critical, because oftentimes those unmet needs become needs that can be life-threatening. A list of unmet needs might include the status of her two sons. She's certainly concerned about them and needing to communicate with them. She might have problems with heating of her house. Most patients in rural areas of the Southwest have problems controlling the climate of their house, warmth during the winter time, and cooling during the summer times. She has a concern for her sister because the sister requires medication as well as equipment for her continuous ambulatory peritoneal dialysis. She's also concerned about her sister's health status. The patient herself is at risk for falls and infection, as we mentioned above. She's also very concerned about rejecting her transplant if, for some reason, because of this calamity that's occurred with this huge storm and not anybody to come and get to her, she's very, very concerned about the ongoing need for her medication, and that she knows that she needs to take it. And if she doesn't get her medication, she could be at risk for rejection of her transplant. She's concerned about her diet and because she's on a low sodium and low protein diet as well, and she's been on that for many, many years. And she's finally concerned about the status of the livestock and the animals that are around her. Many of our Native American people have large spreads where there's animals involved, and many times they're as concerned about the animals as they are about the people. So we recognize that any life or limb-threatening injury, a disease, including respiratory or cardiovascular disease, would take priority. In other words, a cardiac arrest, obviously, a respiratory arrest in any situation takes priority. But it is clear that her that the patient and her family have needs that are not considered emergent at this time, but I really question it, and I questioned at the time whether or not, in fact, many of these needs were either A, unmet, or realized by the patient as being emergent. Any concern of the patient is considered to be emergent. We also do not know the status of the other families in the area. Who also would be affected by the storm. However, the unmet needs are usually of most concern for the patient and may not even be mentioned by the patient. Again, this kind of stresses what I just said earlier. Sometimes what is obvious to a caregiver, whether it's the physician or even a family member, is not what is important to the patient. And I think that's the critical thing in these times of disaster. And those unmet needs become magnified, and they oftentimes can have a very unsettling effect or even a disastrous effect on the patient. And then how can the patient adequately prepare for an emergency? So I'm kind of going on with some of the questions that I think people need to think about as we go through this brief scenario. The next part that I just wanted to briefly mention, and I'm not going to go through this in great detail, is a 72-hour essential preparation checklist. And this involves over 50 items that I've kind of gone through the literature and tried to relate to a whole list of food and water communication, light sources, hygiene, sanitation, tools, warmth and shelter, first aid, miscellaneous, et cetera. But it's a whole long list that I won't go through. But oftentimes patients are ill-equipped and ill-provided with any kind of information, and I certainly think that this is something that needs to be emphasized and discussed further on as we go through this conference. The most important thing here is that many of the patients that I've seen over many, many years of practice is that they do not keep records of their allergies, of the medications that they're on, or even their medical history or their past surgeries. In this scenario, this lady has a long-standing history of chronic kidney disease with diabetes, who's previously been on hemodialysis and now has a transplant. And certainly she's responsible for taking her medications, and she knows that, and that these medications are vital for not only the survival of her kidney, but her well-being as well. I think all those are very integral to the concerns that she would have at this point. The next part I wanted to go into is the action required on her part, and this is kind of the final aspect of this brief talk. But I wanted to really emphasize again the coupling of the patient's responsibility, the coupling of the patient's unmet needs to the ABCs, to the access to health care, to the access to emergent providers, the access to communication, and to the critical nature oftentimes that arises in these situations, in situations that we may not be even aware of, the basic needs of the person and communication, the ABCs really have to be emphasized. So again, I'm paralleling the ABCs of acute care medicine to those of a disaster medicine, and I'm coupling those to the patient who's uncertain, who's worried, who's grappling with a multiplicity of different medical problems, but really the not knowing is probably the paramount. The ongoing is what's happening to her family, and then what am I going to do is really the things that maybe concern her. So I come back to the final part of action required by her, and really the action required by those that have the responsibility of taking care of her, either the providers themselves or the family. In this multifaceted scenario, the needs may seem overwhelming, and certainly many people would think of this as maybe not typical, but in the Southwest, with a very rural, poor population of people, this is more typical than atypical. However, what is required to triage, separate, or prioritize those needs into effective action is really what's important here. Most patients and their families are ill-equipped to handle emergencies or disasters, much less when they themselves are disabled or consumed with health problems. And really, this is the theme of the scenario, is that you have someone that's so overwhelmed at times with their own problems that they're unable to take care of themselves, much less anyone else, and yet they have all these concerns. In rural areas, the cell phone and reliable transportation are essential. Particularly the cell phone in the last several years has really saved countless people's lives, but that's not always reliable either. In addition, weather conditions, and certainly in this situation where it was a very, very severe, disastrous winter, can obviously change dramatically, putting further stress on the patient and or the caregiver. I think oftentimes we're more concerned about what's going to happen than what has already happened. The biggest concern seems to be safety of myself and others, and what is going to happen next? What can I do to enhance my preparedness? What resources do I have that can help me with this? And the safety issues include access to cell phone, landline, news, radio conditions, road conditions, fire, rescue, police, and healthcare. I think those, again, kind of go without saying, but I'm, again, getting back to the coupling or the access, the A, and the B is the basic needs, and the C is communication. But I'm really kind of reiterating, again, the access to healthcare and the access to these communication devices is really key. The second thing is the basic needs, the B, food, shelter, water, clothing, first aid, medications, unmet needs and concerns need to be addressed. Stockpiles of food and water, hardly anybody provides with those. The changing conditions and health needs are certainly, I've discussed those a little bit. What is going to happen to me is a question that oftentimes patients ask, and really hasn't been adequately addressed again in the literature that I've reviewed. And what if I run out of my medication? What's going to happen? What's going to happen to my kidney? What's going to happen to my sister if she runs out of her supplies for her CAPD? And finally, the C is communication. Radio, cell phone, landline, word of mouth, a runner. Oftentimes in rural areas, somebody needs, just like in a military situation, needs to run from one post to another in order to provide information to people. So that's kind of the whole scenario of this patient and her family. A little bit about the preparation and action that I've thought about, and I'd just like to finish with. I know I apologize for taking so much time. Just a little bit about a conclusion and trying to wrap all this up. Again, I think that if, for those that are taking notes, and I would encourage everyone to do that, and any questions would certainly be welcome, a case study has been presented that highlights the unique characteristic and needs of a kidney transplant patient and her family during a time of natural disaster. Critical areas of concern include unmet needs, such as her risk of infection, blood pressure poorly controlled, rejection of transplant, concern that medications will run out. And that's really the primary thing that most patients are concerned about. They run out of medications, they feel they're going to lose their kidney. Number two is the welfare of her family members, her sister, and her sibling, and her two sons. The fact that the sister also is not doing as well, perhaps, as she should on CAPD, and she has diabetes as well. This involves communication. This involves compassion on the part of the people that are caring for them and the understanding that these are very difficult circumstances. Number three would be supplies required for her sister's CAPD, and really, again, it gets back to the medication issue. And four, the heating of her house was of concern, the basic needs when the snow was piling up over 2 feet, and the concern finally was also about her animal stock, and a lot of people think that might not be of concern, But again, when we talk about unmet needs, those are something that comes to mind in terms of what the patient's concerned about. So we have the patient's concern of not knowing, involves access, which is the A. The ongoing entails basic needs, which is health care, food, warmth, shelter, and medications. And the to-doing requires communication with others. So I'll leave everyone with that, and hopefully that this summary and this scenario will be a link towards further discussion and really getting into this topic so that we can provide care to this unique group of patients. And it's really been a privilege to spend time with folks today and to present this scenario and a little bit of a discussion about it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thank you, Dr. Kern. And with great pleasure, we're going to segue into a discussion from Marion O'Rourke.
Thank you, Kathy, and thank you very much, Dr. Kern, for a very insightful review of a patient's needs during a disaster. And a lot of what you've covered, it was interesting to hear it from the perspective of how it related to what I'm going to describe, and certainly the ABCs are a common thread in terms of access, basic needs, and certainly communications. And so I'm going to talk with you about what happened to the transplant program here as a result of Katrina. And just to give you a little bit of background about our facility that kind of puts it in perspective is Tulane University Hospital and Clinic. It's located in downtown New Orleans, not very far from the French Quarter. And it's an acute care tertiary, about 240 beds. And it is owned partly by Healthcare Corporations of America, 80% owned. And I think that's a key piece of information that I will allude to as we go further into this. Our transplant program has about, at the time of Katrina, about 600 patients on our kidney waiting list. We were averaging about 240 transplants a year, which included primarily kidney transplants, but also liver transplant, pancreas transplant, and intestinal transplant. And post-transplant, we were following about 800 patients in total. We had probably about 75 patients on our liver transplant waiting list at the time, and a significant number of liver disease patients that we also were responsible for. What our standard emergency preparedness, you can imagine for any institution in this part of the country that is prone to hurricane season, which is from June 1st through November 30th, every facility has an emergency preparedness plan to handle this. And essentially what the plan is that within the hospital, as many patients as possible are discharged to home ahead of time, and obviously a hurricane is something that we do have some warning of. And the hospital brings in minimum of two shifts that remain at the hospital for the duration, and they stock up on food, supplies, all essential items that we would need to be able to run the facility for at least 7 days without outside help. From a transplant perspective, we consider the transplant program as being a non-essential program that the hospital maintains with an impending disaster. So we traditionally suspend our organ offers from UNOS, and all of the transplant staff, except for our inpatient nursing staff and for whatever physicians would be on call at the facility, are all advised to evacuate or do whatever the city is basically recommending. And basically we provide outpatient access with our on-call system, so access for patients to a nurse and to a physician as we would in after hours. So Katrina hit, and basically right after Katrina on Monday, the hospital has sustained very minor structural damage. All of the patients and staff at the hospital were safe, and the transplant staff that were scattered at this point to different points of where we had evacuated to were planning on when we were going to return to the city and back to work, and so things did not seem too bad at all. And then, of course, the levees broke, and there was severe flooding of about two-thirds of the city. Tulane Hospital, as I mentioned, which is located downtown, was flooded. And it became apparent within a very short period of time that there was not going to be any assistance from the city or the state or any federal assistance that was going to arrive anytime soon. So HCA, which is Healthcare Corporations of America, as I mentioned, that is a part owner, majority owner of the facility, at that point knew that they were going to have to take control of the situation and plan for an immediate evacuation. HCA also owns many hospitals in Florida, and of course they had lots of experience. A number of their facilities were damaged during the previous hurricane season in 2004, and so they had learned a lot from their experience there. An evacuation happened at the hospital over the period of the next couple of days. It was an air evacuation. There was no access by road, or there was no boats in the city to do by water, which you would think might have been something that would have been thought of, but considering all the water we had around. And in the duration of this evacuation, because one of the generators had been damaged and another one ran out of oil before a tanker could get in and refuel, they lost all air conditioning and electricity on Wednesday. And so most of the patients and staff that were still at the facility were actually moved out into the parking garage. And part of this was also concerns about safety within the hospital, because as you can imagine, a hospital has many entrances and exits, and it was almost impossible for the security to man all of those areas. And so the decision was made to actually evacuate the hospital to a controlled area, which was a parking garage that basically had one entrance and one exit. And by Friday, the last of 1,500 people were airlifted from the hospital. The majority of those people were staff, family members of staff, who, if staff are part of those two shifts that come into the facility in preparation for a disaster, they are given the option to have their family with them. You can imagine for parents it would be difficult to have them send their children off to be evacuated somewhere else in the region when they are actually going to be at the hospital. And we're happy to say we had no patient deaths at the facility during this process. And so now, just to focus a little bit on what happened with transplant, by Monday evening and into Tuesday, we were all watching TV as the rest of the country was, and became apparent that this is a very, very serious situation. We had essentially lost all communication with the hospital administration at that point in time. And HCA, which is our parent company, their focus was on the immediate evacuation of the hospital. There were no telephone services. Cell phone was very, very sporadic, almost non-existent for the first couple of days. The only method of communication that was working was text messaging, and obviously email, if you had access to email. Most of the transplant staff at this point are scattered pretty much around the country. And for the most part, we did not know where everybody was, and because everybody left on Friday expecting we're all going to be back together at some point in the following week and back to work, same as normal. But obviously that was not the case. We clearly recognized at this point the physicians and myself and many of the coordinators and other staff that managed to make communication with each other, that we were responsible for a very high-risk patient population, that we're dependent on ongoing health care, and most immediately that might have issues with access to medications in particular. The first priorities for us at that point was a communication, and we were able to transfer our phone line for the access to the transplant program to a exchange in Nashville. And by doing that, we were actually able to get that line working again so people could actually call us. It was very rudimentary for the first day or two. It was essentially just an answering machine, And those transplant staff that had made contact with each other and were starting to kind of establish a core group of people, even though we're scattered around the country, but at least we were communicating, manned that answering machine, took messages off at every half hour, and returned calls and dealt with situations as best we could. There was a lot of independent decision-making going on, as you can imagine, at this point. We also then started to collect email addresses as people contacted us, as staff contacted us. We got a section created on our website that we posted everybody's personal contact information at this point. Any information that anybody could give was posted publicly. Many of our staff and our patients who were very resourceful during this time period did actually check the website and was able to make contact with us through that. We also had an email address for people to be able to reach us. Our staff that were in the Louisiana area actually at this point started to drive around the community that they were in, checking in with any of our referring physician base, our dialysis units that were still running, the nephrologist, hepatologist, and basically providing a way for those physicians to contact a member of the transplant team if a patient showed up and was in need of care. Within probably about 4 days, we had established a satellite clinic in Baton Rouge, which is about an hour's drive from New Orleans, and also one in Lafayette, which is about 3 hours from New Orleans. And again, we were able to do this very quickly because these were facilities that are sister HCA hospitals. At this point, we know all of our patients have been evacuated from Tulane, including any of the transplant patients, and they were all evacuated to an intermediary site, which was within Louisiana, which were not transplant centers. And so then the job was to get those patients transferred to transplant centers around the country. And I would have to say that all of the transplant centers, no matter where they were located, were very, very generous in accepting these patients with no medical records and very little information in many cases. Our social workers, we actually had one social worker that was in contact with us out of three at that point, and the social worker and our inpatient coordinator at the time were designated as the two staff that would provide assistance to patients that were in need of medications. And so they worked with the patient assistance programs, all of whom made emergency access available and negated the need for the detailed applications that would be the normal practice. And most pharmacies around the country had, at that point, made everybody aware that they would supply a renewal, a refill of medications to patients if they could at least tell the pharmacy what dose of medication they were on and what frequency. So prescriptions were not required. And then over the course of the next couple of days, a lot of activity in terms of what is the future going to be and is there going to be a transplant program. We did not know at this point how severely damaged the facility was, whether it was going to reopen or not. You have to understand also just the general destruction of the infrastructure here and the mass exodus and evacuation of people. There was a real concern over what the future was going to hold, even for transplant. We did make a decision at that point, however, that we were not going to try to restart our program at another facility in Louisiana, and that was something that we did seriously consider, but because of the really terrible healthcare infrastructure that was in Louisiana at the time, and because we did not feel that transplant was such an essential service that we needed to add an additional burden onto that healthcare service, we elected not to reactivate our waiting list and not to start doing organ transplants. Our focus was on providing care to our existing patients that were either on the waiting list for an organ transplant or our post-transplant patients. We also didn't have a blood bank that was flooded. Our HLA lab had been flooded. And we were also dealing with the fact that there was a huge emotional and psychological impact on everybody, so not just our patients, but also our staff. And during this time when many of us were back trying to either work within Louisiana or work remotely, many of us did not actually know whether our homes were intact or what our personal situations were. So just trying to get people to focus on high-level stuff such as organ transplants at that time just seemed to be not the priority. And so we essentially suspended our transplant program in respect of accepting organs for transplant indefinitely, and we awaited the reopening of Tulane Hospital, which happened in February of 06. And we reactivated our waiting list on February 21st in January, and pretty much have been back to almost normal practices right now for the program. So I'd like to just kind of go back and highlight a couple of the lessons that were learned during this experience for us. And one is transplant is an essential service when you think more long-term, certainly not within that immediate couple of days in and around a disaster, but it is something that we need to consider as being an essential service, which I think Dr. Kern certainly highlighted very well for us. We do need to have a very robust disaster preparedness plan, and you have to plan for the worst-case scenario because, unfortunately, it will happen. And I think key to any disaster plan is a really good communication plan, both for your patients and for your employees. And we also need to think about how are we going to provide direct patient care and how are we going to give our patients access to life-sustaining medications. Some of the essential information that we feel as a transplant program we are responsible to being able to access in case of a disaster is contact information for all of our patients, very basic medical status information. We also, an interesting issue that we came across was our patients that were in research studies, and we had many active research studies, and one which was a really difficult one to deal with in this circumstance was a research study where the immunosuppressive agent is provided intravenously. And so that presented a whole other dilemma and problem for us to resolve, which time doesn't permit us to go into here. We also need to have, obviously, contacts for all of our employees and also kind of establish a chain of command, have a call cascade in place for your employees, and be able to have your employees identify ahead of time who might be available for immediate and kind of short-range provision of care in such a situation. During this time, one of the key things I think that we were able to do was reestablish our telephone access for patients to the transplant team members. We also had our website and an email address that patients could communicate with us via email. In order to provide easy access to both patients, community physicians, and other transplant programs where our patients were showing up, we also posted, as I mentioned, all of our personal contact information. So if Dr. Kern happened to be in receipt of one of our patients, he could have gone on our website and actually contacted one of our surgeons directly, as opposed to necessarily having to go through a central contact. And so that certainly was very helpful. We also provided UNOS, and UNOS did serve as a central kind of reservoir of information and sharing of information for us. We provided them with all of our contact numbers, and they also were the kind of conduit of information between other programs and patients who were having difficulty getting access to transplant care and with us. And I think in the interest of time, I'll kind of wrap it up here and just say that from a patient's perspective, I think what we need our patients to realize, and as Dr. Kern alluded, is many of our patients are not at all prepared for even some bad, minor disasters in terms of its environmental impact, perhaps, and the long-term impact of it, but which certainly can have a significant impact on transplant patients. So I would suggest that all patients need to be educated that they have to have a written list of their medications, or they need to be able to know what medications they are on, what dose, and what frequency. They also need to be able to recite a brief history of their condition, and if reciting it is not going to be possible, then to have something in writing. They should, I believe, have a telephone number for UNOS, the 1-800 number, because I would see UNOS acting as that central contact reservoir for transplant programs in future situations like this. The other thing that we are suggesting to our patients is that they think about having a short supply of medications in a waterproof container. It's probably not realistic to ask patients as they're evacuating with an impending disaster or something on those lines to grab a box of medications, but at least have a couple of days' supply. And then to establish contact with either our program or any transplant program, no matter where you arrive in the country, find the closest transplant program, and that is easy to do by a patient making contact with UNOS. They'll identify the closest transplant center. And I think from the transplant center's perspective, what we need from patients is that they keep their contact information accurate with us at all times, and that was a significant issue that we faced as we tried to find all of our patients and reconnect with all of our patients, was to find that contact numbers that we had were not even actually accurate anymore pre-Katrina, let alone after the disaster. We would also suggest that patients provide us with a telephone number of a contact person outside of the local geographic region. So essentially the region that you think might be hit with a disaster of this nature, that you really need to provide a telephone number of someone outside that area. And we actually require that now of all of our employees, that they do that. We also suggest that all of our patients had a cell phone, and I think Dr. Kern may have alluded to that as well. And if at all possible, that all of our patients either have an email address or certainly would have access to an email address or certainly would be willing to establish one relatively quickly in the event of a disaster. And so those would be some of the recommendations I would make from the lessons that we learned. And I think with that, I will finish here and hand it back to Kathy.
Well, thank you so much, Marion. And with great pleasure, we're going to segue now to Deborah Washington.
Thank you very much. I'm talking a little bit about preparation for your organ recipients related to natural disasters and emergencies. We keep in mind that the recipient is unique in that the immune system has been compromised. The anti-rejection medications are quite beneficial in maintaining the life of the organ, but of course the side effects leave the patient with an elevated risk of infection, which of course can lead to rejection. A common cold experienced by the healthy person can lead to pneumonia and organ rejection in the recipient. Recipients have a special role in preparing for their personal safety during times of distress. Concerns about immunosuppression, dehydration, infection, organ failure, or rejection are constant reminders of the unique category that we fall into. Exposure to excessive heat, cold, contaminated water, food, close quarters with ill contacts can all cause a significant negative impact on the transplanted organ. You will hear information that will be pertinent to every human being upon this earth, with particular interest toward the organ recipient. Memories of the Asian tsunami, Hurricane Katrina, and the ravaging fires throughout the West Coast are forever embedded in our minds. Exposure to high temperatures can also cause problems for the recipient. Dehydration can lead to an imbalance in electrolytes, low blood pressure, and various conditions that can affect all major organs. Harmful effects from the sun include sunburn, of course, skin cancer. The Hurricane Katrina and the tornadoes in Arkansas just a few weeks ago are situations in which no amount of preparation would have been enough to confront the devastation that was left behind. The key to survival is an emergency plan, of course, as everyone has mentioned so far, attention to detail, and the presence of mind to evacuate when ordered. Recipients should keep in mind that tangible items can be replaced. The human life cannot. I will concentrate on two scenarios. One, the recipient is able to remain at home, and two, the recipient is forced to evacuate. First, I'd like to speak a little bit about an emergency bag that would prove beneficial for both scenarios. I suggest a rolling, waterproof backpack with a side pocket for bottled water. This backpack should be packed with travel size items. We don't want to make it too heavy because we want to avoid developing a hernia at the incision site. Don't want to place any glass items in the emergency kit because you don't want to get yourself cut while you're traveling and moving about trying to get to safety. I do have a list of items, but I'd like for you to refer to the NKS brochure on planning for natural disasters and other emergencies for a more detailed list. I will highlight a few of the items that will be quite beneficial during your evacuation, or if you have to stay at home, both of them will be quite beneficial. Antibacterial wipes, of course, bottled water. I recommend a calling card. There has been lots mentioned of a cell phone, but we must keep in mind that the cell phone is only as good as the battery that you have in there. Once the battery dies, you're pretty much in trouble. There's also that standard corded phone. A lot of folks don't realize that once the power goes out, if you have a corded phone, then you will still have communication. Disposable masks are great to put in this backpack because if you're around other folks, if you're in a shelter and you're in close quarters and folks are coughing and you're dealing with all kind of different odors and different bacteria, the mask is going to help in and help you not necessarily be exposed to a whole bunch of bacteria. Hand sanitizer is wonderful. In the home, you can also keep some low-sodium canned goods. I've noticed now that some of the stores are stocking canned goods with a little flip-top device. You don't even need a can opener. Non-perishable snacks are great. There are some things for toilet paper, of course. They have little travel-sized toilet paper. Ziploc bags, I cannot stress the importance of Ziploc bags. There's one item that all of us, all of the recipients, and dialysis patients should keep, which is a laminated card with the following information: name, address, phone number, an emergency contact, telephone numbers for the physician and the pharmacist, a complete list of medication with the strength and frequency, a list of allergies, type and date of transplant, and any other health care information that the folks that are going to be receiving you need to know. Once you pack this bag with all these essential items, do not tamper with it. Keep it in a place that is ready, accessible. If you should have to evacuate, all you want to do is grab this bag, put your medications in a waterproof bag, and hit the road. Most physicians will write a 90-day prescription with 2 to 3 refills. It is wise to order refills when you reach at least a 14-day balance. The shelter-bound recipient must be very careful in regards to their closest contacts. Close quarters with someone who is obviously ill is not advised. Keep in mind that children carry a lot of germs with their runny nose and coughs and sneezes and dirty hands. If you have to go to a shelter, let the intake coordinator know of your status as a transplant recipient. If they don't seem to understand the immunosuppression status, then ask, of course, to speak to someone else and who has a little bit more medical knowledge than the person who's receiving you there. Find out if they can put you in a cot that's in a corner or somewhere at the end of a row so you don't necessarily have to be in anyone else's space. Like I said, I mentioned that mask before. These masks will come in handy. And many times if other folks see you walking around with a mask on, they won't come near you anyhow. And that will be to the recipient's benefit at that time when you're in close quarters. In your home, extend your power outages, loss of water, and inclement weather can cause a huge imposition upon the lifestyle. a few basic household items that may not be necessarily viewed as emergency items will come in quite handy. Some of them I will identify, and you'll be pleased to learn that many of the recipients have these items in their home, but they don't look at them as emergency items. Of course, medications, we have to keep those. Blankets, batteries. A battery-operated clock will help you keep you oriented to what's going on outside. Bottled water is very inexpensive now, so it would be nice when you do your shopping, just grab another six-pack of bottled water and keep that in an area that's easily accessible should you need it. Comfortable walking shoes are a must, especially for the diabetics. But if in the case of evacuation, you might have to do some walking, so that's when you want to grab your shoes and be comfortable when you have to do that. A charcoal grill, a lighter fluid, all that will help feed you. You don't want your food to go bad, so if necessary, you can have a block party and you all just pull out the grill and at least you'll have a nice meal. A cooler is good to have at home. Some of these things will be expensive and everyone won't be able to afford it, but some of the things that they will have at home, flashlights, batteries, hand sanitizer, Lysol, and, of course, your medication. I cannot stress medication enough. Usually when you have an emergency, if you have your medications, you can survive. A few niceties are also suggested, like as far as a battery-operated television. I recently purchased one at Macy's for $20, a battery-operated clock and radio, electric fan, electric heater, fireproof safe. A fireproof safe is actually wonderful because there are the paperwork that we have to take care of, and these will really help if something happens and we have to leave our home and someone has to come back and find out what we have left behind. As far as the vehicle is concerned, try to maintain the vehicle as best you can. Perform the routine scheduled maintenance. Try to keep at least a half tank of gas in your vehicle at all times. Keep a blanket, flashlight, and some extra water in the trunk of the car. You don't want to spend a whole lot of time stopping to pick up all these items. You'll have a huge advantage of other folks who have to stop to buy gas. You'll be able to just pass them along the way as they're sitting in line trying to get gas. And, of course, while we don't like to talk about death, it is a reality. Everyone will not survive. Whether a result of a traumatic injury, disease, or natural occurrence, attention to administrative measures is imperative for everyone. Power of attorney is great, and it should be given to someone in another town or city. And the reason I say that is because if you lose your personal items, if everything is blown away in a hurricane or tornado, then the next person, your nearest neighbor, will probably lose everything too. So put all your paperwork safely with someone that you can trust. That's, I say, maybe 40, 50 miles away from you, so all this can be safe. Memorize the Social Security number and your most active bank account. Memorize your medication. A medic alert bracelet is also helpful when to give notice to EMT personnel. Prepare a will and prepare a living will. You should discuss with your family your final arrangements. We're experiencing this Anna Nicole story right now. We don't want anything to we don't want to linger in a funeral home for 3-4 weeks or months and stuff like that. We don't want them here fighting about what to do with our final remains. And again, discuss with your family organ and tissue donation, because you may be able to at least donate some tissue to someone else should you not survive this disaster. Also, during the disaster, the recipient should be aware of various signs and symptoms of infection, such as fever, chills, nausea, vomiting, pain at the transplant site, general malaise, and loss of appetite. This is one you have to report to whoever you're closest emergency contact with. If you're there in a shelter or if you're at home, call 911, call your doctor, let them know that you're not feeling well, and do your best to seek medical care. You probably noticed that I haven't said anything about money. And that's because I cannot say enough about money. Emergency situation can cause a financial strain on the entire family. I advise the recipients to establish an emergency fund for use during difficult times. The safest route would probably be a bank account. ATM cards, of course, quite convenient, but they become attractive to others in the same situations who wish you harm. Memorize your account number. Do not document it on your contact information, because then you're going to have another emergency. Someone will steal your belongings, and you'll just be in worse shape than you were to begin with. Emergency folks in the shelters will help you with contacting your bank or your credit union. Make every effort to maintain your health, home, and car insurance. We realize that with Hurricane Katrina, even the home insurance wasn't enough because a lot of people were affected and homes still have not been replaced. And I pray that all this will be straightened out soon. We are powerless in changing the path of Mother Nature, but we certainly can prepare for events like this. I've spoken of issues surrounding the organ recipient and suggested some practices that could make a stressful time a little bit more tolerable. Whether you are at home or if you have to leave, if you can have your medications on hand, you will probably survive. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Bruce, thank you so very much.
You're quite welcome.
And with great pleasure, we're going to segue to Dean Collier.
Thank you, Kathy.
Sure.
I'm honored to have the opportunity to be involved with this program. In all of the conversations I've had with patients over the years, honestly, I can't recall providing detailed instruction on how to survive a disaster. The thought just never crossed my mind. How to get through a weekend, how to travel, yes, but a disaster, no. Events of the last few years have given me pause to rethink the information that I share with patients. Before I begin, I would like to recognize the Omaha Metropolitan Medical Response System, and I'd like to personally thank Dr. Fred Masumi, who was tremendously helpful in preparing the material that I'll talk about today. I'll concentrate on pharmacy-related issues that can be addressed by you, the social workers or healthcare providers, and your transplant recipients that you're caring for, so that all of you may be best prepared for catastrophic events. First, I'd like to reinforce advice already passed along. Take control in being prepared. Every recipient needs to know their medications and why they take them. It's not enough to know them by that little white pill or two of the big round orange pills twice a day. That's just not enough. In reading about the experiences of the healthcare providers that aided Katrina victims, one of the biggest hurdles for them was trying to find out what medicines the victims had been taking and why they took them. Among the 160 Katrina refugees that landed here in Omaha, only one person knew their medications. In Omaha, we had medicines or suitable substitutes available for them, but guesswork slowed down the actual treatment. As Deborah mentioned, your patients should be advised to keep a list of all medicines, their doses, and the schedules. They need to keep the list up to date. They need to keep it on their person and in the emergency bag that Deborah mentioned. With the list of medicines, also a good idea, keep the contact number of your doctor and your pharmacist. You might reinforce this advice to your patients by asking the question, who do you think will be your doctor or pharmacist in an emergency? The victim of a disaster will not likely get care from a familiar face. Any care they receive will likely be from someone unfamiliar to them, from another town or even another state. Also consider that the caregiver they get may be trained in another discipline and therefore may not be comfortable with even internal medicine issues. The caregiver will be even less likely to have knowledge of transplant medicines. It's so specialized. I think of perhaps a pediatrician treating an adult patient, or nurses who are skilled in geriatrics helping out with children. That's the kind of care that's going to happen in an emergency situation. The point is, you can't predict what help will come, and you need to be prepared to help the caregiver help you. Advise your patients to avoid being passive about the care they receive, especially if the caregiver is unfamiliar with them. Advise them to inform the caregiver at the start, I'm a transplant recipient and I take immune suppressive medicines. Inform them, what are those medicines? If it's determined that a new medicine is needed for that patient, then that patient should ask if any of the new medicines will affect the medicines they're currently taking for transplant. There are many, many drug-drug interactions that will greatly increase the immunosuppressive effects or the unwanted adverse effects of the most commonly prescribed anti-rejection drugs. As a result, the transplant patient can get into very serious trouble in a very short time if we give the wrong combination. Because transplant medicine is so specialized, this information is just not commonly known by those outside of transplant medicine. I would also second Deborah's advice for patients to wear or keep some form of identification on them, acknowledging that they are a transplant recipient, in case they're not able to verbalize such. The transplant recipient should always have a supply of medicines on hand. They should never allow themselves to be only a day away from needing a refill. The challenge here is how much should I keep on hand, or how do I get that extra supply? First, how much should they keep on hand? I would suggest a week's supply is adequate to get oneself through a crisis situation. A week should allow time to make the necessary contacts to obtain refills from your pharmacy or another supplier. Now, how do we go about getting an extra week's supply of medicines? Because, you know, insurance can get in the way. Well, there are a couple of options. First, a one-time emergency refill of a week or a two-week supply of medications may be requested. This would be a refill in addition to one's usual refills of medicines. Second, we may be able to get a refill of prescriptions earlier than they are actually due. Most insurers will allow their patients to refill prescriptions up to 5 to 7 days early. So there's your week. The pharmacist should not object to this, especially if the patient shares with them the rationale for why they're getting the refill early. Having an extra supply of medications on hand with it adds additional responsibilities. The supply must be well stored. For most oral medications, temperature extremes and moisture needs to be avoided. For other medications, refrigeration may be necessary. As Deborah mentioned, the watertight containers are an excellent idea. Also, the supply, I think, needs to be dated, and the patient periodically needs to recycle the supply into their own day-to-day supply. I would think so that the medicine doesn't become outdated. I would think that 6 months is a reasonable time for most transplant-related medications. Every 6 months, they should recycle that extra supply. The limits of having an extra supply on hand must also be recognized. Now, if one's home is wiped out, as in a tornado, chances are the extra supply of medicines will be gone as well. So that prospect reinforces the contact information and knowledge of one's own medications and how important that really is. A source of information for the general public on preparedness can be found at the following website, www.ready.gov. There's a very nice list at that website. Patients can read and download plans and checklists to prepare for emergencies. You know, a question was raised in preparing for this program. Will a pharmacy keep a supply of my patient's transplant medications on the shelf in case of emergency? The answer is probably not. The expense is too great. Those medicines, Prograf and Neural, are terribly expensive. It would be too costly for the average pharmacy to keep those medicines sitting on their shelf. And you may be aware that select pharmacies across your cities and states have been requested to stock emergency supplies of medicines as part of disaster response. But for the most part, those medicines are antibiotics, and those medicines are reserved for persons determined to be essential personnel and their families. Now, something that might be done short of having having transplant medication stored on the shelf would be working with the pharmacy in the area to create an action plan. With a plan in place, a pharmacist might be more efficient at anticipating the needs of transplant recipients and obtaining the medications that they need in a more timely manner. Let me move on to discuss how a medication refill might take place in an emergency. If the patient is known to the pharmacist, there really shouldn't be a problem. As mentioned earlier, emergency refills are possible. When a patient is unknown to the pharmacist, as might happen when an entire community is affected, it's more challenging. The pharmacist has a responsibility to verify that a relationship exists between the care provider and the patient needing medicines. This can be handled over the phone, even in cases of out-of-state providers. The pharmacist might request of the person calling in a provider's DEA number as a form of verification. The pharmacist may even obtain prescription records from another pharmacy and perform an emergency partial fill of the prescriptions without a formal transfer of that patient's prescriptions. Now, I recognize laws may be different among the states on this issue. Nebraska just recently clarified their laws on this matter, and I would advise you as a resource for clarification on this, call or contact your state's State Board of Pharmacy. One last thing, I was reminded by our pharmacy law instructor that when a pharmacist is acting in good faith to provide care in an emergency, they're unlikely to face any adverse legal consequences from their actions. And this might be helpful in a discussion with a reluctant caregiver or pharmacist. The aforementioned material included mostly information and advice to pass along to the transplant recipient. But there's more. As healthcare providers, we need to become more prepared. Now, I spoke with representatives from two national pharmacy organizations in my research on this disaster preparedness. Neither group had taken action in the form of plans or advice for their constituents. Both groups recognized the issue and felt it was important, but had not yet acted. This needs to be done. It's a multidisciplinary effort, and it needs to take place at personal, community, state, and national levels. For example, we are advising patients to keep records of their medications up to date and keep them safe. Well, let's look at ourselves. How's your record keeping? Do you have all of your files on paper? Are your files electronic? Are they backed up? If they're backed up, where is that backup located? These things should be taken into consideration. Many patient records were lost in Katrina. Damp and molding paper was not salvageable. I suspect on-site computers would not have fared much better. This gives rise to the thought of a database of information in more than one location. For pharmacy records, the chain pharmacies are somewhat ahead in this area. If chain drugstore X is destroyed in one city, a sister store in another city can readily retrieve a patient's information. In the future, I believe much of one's personal medical record will be handled the same way. Personal health information accessible through the Internet, I think, will be of great benefit in these crisis situations. Of course, the risk is easy to see, and that's Internet hacking and loss of personal health information if it's not well protected. Listening to the program today is a good thing, but it's still not enough. It's a good first step, but there's more that you have to do. You have to get involved. Review the recommendations of the panel today. Consider things that will work for you. Do some research of your own. Make contact with other healthcare providers in your area to discuss, plan, and if one doesn't already exist, create a network that can respond effectively to tragedy. You can find local networks through the website, www.ready.gov. It's a great website. And if you go to that website, click on Be Informed. It will take you to another web page with a map of the United States. Click on your state, and you should find contact information for state and local organizations involved with disaster preparedness. You can register yourself to become part of a national disaster response service. The United States Department of Health and Human Services has such a registry for a partnership of persons willing to be called upon in an emergency. The registry is called the National Disaster Medical System, and the website for the National Disaster Medical System is www.oep-ndms.dhhs.gov. You can get involved at the community level. There's help on the web for Community Emergency Response Teams, or CERT. You can see if one exists in your area by going to the Citizens Corps website, and that is www.citizenscorps.gov/CERT/. I think this web address, I was on it today. They say something about changing in the future, but it's up and active today. If you're not able to find a community emergency response team in your area, there are directions on that web page on how to start one. This would be a great place, I think, to provide advance notice to care providers of the presence of patients in your area who, in the event of a disaster, would have special needs. Another resource for disaster preparedness that I'll mention is the United Way. Among other things that the United Way has championed, one has been the 211 telephone service. It's somewhat like 911. The 211 service is an easy-to-remember emergency telephone number with the purpose of providing community volunteer and human service information and referral. Basically, the service will coordinate medical and non-medical needs, donations, and services during a crisis. You can find out more about what the United Way can offer by visiting their website at www.national.unitedway.org. One last thing. In the event of a disaster, patients involved should be instructed to look for Red Cross volunteers. I understand that the Red Cross was instrumental in collecting information on victims and creating a registry that connected separated families. Knowledge of this can help you find your patients, and you can report to the Red Cross your knowledge of patients in the area so the Red Cross may better provide for them. Thank you for listening today, and I encourage you to explore the different resources and take in the advice that was mentioned today. And I think most importantly, we've got to get involved. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much, Dean. And the websites that Dean mentioned will be listed on the NKF website, www.kidney.org, along with a list of Deborah Washington's materials that she has devised for packing and storing. And now we're ready to take some questions or comments from the audience.
Thank you. At this time, if you do have a question or a comment, please press star 1 on your touchtone phone. One moment, please. At this time, I'm not showing anyone with a question or comment.
Okay.
Oh, one moment, ma'am. I do have one party. Excuse me, I do have Sarah Hsu. Your line is open, ma'am.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify what the UNOS general number is that people could call.
Kathy, I can take that one. That's Marion.
Okay.
The number actually that we historically have given out is, well, I actually don't have it right in front of me, but I'll get that as we're talking. But UNOS actually just recently has mandated, for a whole different reason, that transplant centers provide a contact number to all patients at the point of listing. It's actually being provided for reasons that a patient can grieve any decisions that a transplant program might have made about their care. And I have a feeling that that number, if patients have it, that that might be the one that UNOS would suggest that people call. But there is a 1-800 number that they can call also, and I actually don't have it right.
I have it.
Do you have it?
It's an 888, which is a toll-free exchange, 894-6361.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Okay.
Marilyn Sharon, I have your line is open.
Okay, I had, this was wonderful. I learned so many things. So I do so appreciate this. But you all talked very quickly, and on the resources that were listed by the last speaker, there was the WWWOEP, and then everyone went so fast. I didn't get that. I know it's going to be on that the other website you just talked about, and you also spoke so quickly, I didn't get that one.
www.oep-n, as in Nancy,
mm-hmm.
E as in dog, M as in Mary, S as in Sam, dot D dog, H Harry, S Sam, dot gov.
Wonderful. And what was the WWW Citizen Corps?
Okay, Citizen Corps, all one word, CITIZENCORPS dot gov / CERT /
Thank you very much.
Very welcome.
Mm-hmm.
The information will be posted at www.kidney.org. If you click on transplant recipients, it'll take you to a page, Coffee House Conversations, and it will also be posted on the Council of Nephrology Social Work page under What's New. Okay? Now, several of the panelists mentioned the emotional impact of recovering after a disaster, and this is another concern. NKF is pilot testing a new program, Stepping Back into Life, in Louisiana. It's been made available to 60 social workers who have recognized that their patients may be suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, and they themselves may be suffering from secondary post-traumatic stress or compassion fatigue, since they also have been through a terrible ordeal. This is a program that acknowledges that if a person survives an emergency, they're apt to feel anxious, depressed, and have a host of other worries. And Stepping Back into Life, we hope to roll out to the nationwide. It can be delivered by audio tape or in live group, and provides education and practical exercise to aid in emotional recovery. And it was written by social workers. And key messages and exercises are available to the social workers who will be facilitating the Coffee House Conversations Support Group program, of which this whole series that you're listening today is a part of, and it is in your red manual. NKF is also a lead organization with the Kidney Community Emergency Response Coalition, which is a group of stakeholders in the kidney community working together to aid patients in the event of a disaster. The coalition studies, meets, and designs response systems to help transplant recipients and kidney patients survive and manage emergencies. And really, how it works is that one area of the country not affected can be mobilized to launch a relief or rescue response for the part of the country that is, similar to how Dean said that Katrina patients were coming to Nebraska. We know they went all over the whole country, and other groups were mobilized to help them. In addition, the NKF has booklets that Deborah Washington referred to for kidney and other transplant patients to help them prepare for emergencies. And this is available for free, single copies, by calling the NKF 800 number, 800-622-9010. I hope the information you've heard today leaves you with hope and encouragement, as well as practical information about facing and surviving an emergency. Thank you to our Blue Ribbon panel, and thank you to all of our listeners. And good afternoon and good night.